I need to start with really important thank yous. And the perhaps most important is Jeff and Cynthia Higgins, who are the owners of Elaine's and created this amazing literary salon. I am just thrilled that they're here and actually so close to my house and the neighborhood. So big thanks to them for providing this space. Many thanks in particular to the people who put up money for Marcia to be here. That includes the Cultural Office of the Embassy of Spain and Cultural Attaché Antonio Álvarez Barthe and Program Manager Anna Sanvay. Did I pronounce it right? I did. Yay! And also Leah Mehta, the Director of George Mason University's Chu Center for International Writing, who also put up money and time and energy to make sure Marta could come and be here with us and some other events around town. Thank you to Old Town Books. They've got books back there to sell. We're so lucky to have our own indie bookstore here in Alexandria. I just love those guys. So, again, a big call out to Chris Kaiser. I'm going to talk a little bit more about him later because he was the one publisher finally who said, Martha Sons has a unique voice and we need to get her published in English. He also has a great vision for her voice in English. And it was really fun to work with him to try and get to that. So finally, I want to thank you guys all for coming. You're all my dear friends and neighbors, my darling husband, patient reading always the first version of these texts. And probably not the best version, and helping with that. Thank you, all of you. It's. Okay, let's just get started. I want, because Marta is not well known yet in the United States, I want to start with her talking about herself. And here is my question. So, Marta, in a recent interview, you were asked the famous question, if you could have dinner with any three people, living or dead, who would they be? And you answered Marguerite Duras, autofiction author of The Lover and Hiroshima Mon Amour, movies made from both of those books, I think. And then you said Patricia Highsmith, couldn't be more different, psychological thriller, author of Strangers on a Train, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. And Dorothy Parker, again, couldn't be more different, poet, literary critic, and queen of the sardonic wisecracks. Tell us about your choices and how they define you and your work.
Bueno, en primer lugar, muchas gracias por haber venido. Muchas gracias a Katie King. Sin Katie King, mi clavícula no estaría aquí. Katie King es mi hada madrina en Estados Unidos, y muchas gracias también a Chris Kaiser, que ha tenido la sensibilidad y el buen criterio. Entonces estoy tremendamente agradecida.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for coming, and thank you especially to Katie King, because without her, my clavicle wouldn't be here. She is my fairy godmother in the U.S. And thank you also to Chris Kaiser for your sensibility and for your great taste.
Respecto a mis acompañantes a la hora de cenar, tanto Margarita Dura como Patricia Highsmith y como Dorothy Parker, creo que eran tres grandes bebedoras. Y yo en ese momento he dejado de beber.
Regarding my dinner companions, Patricia Highsmith, Dorothy Parker, and Marguerite Duras were great drinkers. And it so happens that I stopped drinking recently.
O sea que en ese momento nuestra sintonía sería completamente literaria. Son tres autoras que yo admiro muchísimo por lo que ha comentado Katie. Margarita Duras, por su capacidad para hablar de cosas muy difíciles, sentimentalmente muy complicadas. Patricia Highsmith también por esa mirada hacia lo oscuro, ese cuestionamiento de qué es moral, qué no es moral, su palabra misteriosa también. Y Dorothy Parker, bueno, Dorothy Parker yo creo que era fabulosa. Una mujer que es capaz de decir, creo que en el vestíbulo del Hotel Plaza de Nueva York, cuando su perro se ha hecho pis en la alfombra y el director sale a decirle, señora, señora, su perro se ha meado. Le dice, no, no, perdone, he sido yo. Es absolutamente fabulosa.
Well, since they were great drinkers and I no longer drink, I think our main synchronicity would be literary because I no longer drink. I admired these three authors so very much. As Katie said, I admired Marguerite Duras because of her ability to talk about absolutely complex things, really, really complex and difficult things to talk about. Regarding Patricia Highsmith, I really admire her ability to glance into darkness. And her ability to discern moral versus not moral, and her ability with the mysterious word. With Dorothy Parker, I think she's just fabulous. I mean, we're talking about a woman that when she went into the Grand Plaza Hotel in New York with her dog peed on the rug. And when the director of the hotel came out and said, ma'am, ma'am, your dog just peed on the rug, she said, it was me. She's fabulous, isn't she? Okay, so we have autobiography, thriller, social satire. Which one of these is my clavicle? What is the story of my clavicle about?
Bueno, Clavícula es un libro autobiográfico y como en todos los libros autobiográficos, la ficción es muy importante, porque yo creo que los seres humanos estamos hechos de nuestras ficciones, de los libros que leemos, de las películas que vemos. Entonces, eso creo que es importante aclararlo en primer lugar.
Well, Clavicle is an autobiographical book, and I think that as with every autobiographical work of fiction, every autobiographical work, fiction is key because I think that we human beings are made up of all the things that we've ingested, the books we've read, the films we've seen.
La parte autobiográfica comienza con una crisis personal en la que yo comienzo a notar que el cuerpo me duele. Hay partes de mi cuerpo que me duelen, fundamentalmente la clavícula, y ese dolor en la clavícula lo que hace es despertar todos mis miedos. El miedo a la muerte, el miedo a la enfermedad, el miedo a la vejez, el miedo a que tu pareja te mire de un modo completamente diferente y también ciertos miedos que tienen que ver con el trabajo, la falta de expectativas y la precariedad económica de muchas personas que nos dedicamos al oficio de escribir.
Well, this autobiographical book started with a personal crisis when I realized that my body hurt, that there were parts of my body that were hurting, and especially my clavicle. And that pain in specific awoke other kinds of fears, my fear of death, my fear of growing old, my fear of sickness, my fear of having my partner look at me differently. And it also awoke other kinds of fears. For example, my fear regarding my professional life, work, the lack of prospects, and also the precarious conditions in which many of us writers have to live.
Entonces yo creo que En este libro es muy importante cómo nuestro cuerpo, nuestra salud, nuestra enfermedad, nuestros dolores se relacionan con nuestro género, nuestra clase, nuestras condiciones de vida, las cosas que nos suceden. Cómo en realidad muchas veces no podemos separar el dentro de nosotros, de lo que pasa fuera. Cómo nos miran a las mujeres, cómo nos miran a ciertas personas frente a otras personas.
So I think that in this book, it's mostly about how our body, our health, and our pain relates to issues like gender, class, and the way we live. How often it's very difficult to separate what's going on inside from what's going on outside and how you are perceived, how people look at you. I'm going to read a passage or two from the book, if that's okay. Read to you guys while you eat, which this passage addresses directly who Marta is as a writer, why she writes, and how that relates to this book. A journalist asks, what inspires you to write? Why do so many people ask me this? Because it's genuinely an interesting question, or because nobody has any imagination anymore when it comes to asking questions or answering them? Whatever anyone asks, my answer is always the same. I explain why I write and what I write about. I mechanically replay the answer that today resonates more strongly than ever. I write about what pains me. I repeat this in 5, 10, 200 interviews. I write about what pains me. Today, I clearly see that writing seeks to name and impose order on chaos, on the chaos of nature, the chaos of demented cells that resist death, the chaos that lurks inside the order of social structures. Writing scrapes away at entropy like a spoon scrapes away at the prison wall. It amputates gangrenous limbs. It identifies the evil of diseases so they can be healed. Writing makes everything just a little bit clearer by tightly tying the giant squid's swirling tentacles with a red velvet ribbon, collecting the black ink it expels into the depths of the abyss, and organizing it into letters of the alphabet. Over time, almost 4 months now, the diagnostic hypotheses produced by my visits to various doctors have shifted. Lung cancer, overexertion, anxiety, heart disease, microvalves, stenosis, esophageal, diverticulum, toothache, fungus, nothing. The tests and their results come back slowly because it's not urgent. But I'm incapable of thinking of anything else. I search everywhere endlessly, trying to find the words to name things. No one mentions the word menopause, talisman, taboo. No one mentions the word menopause or bothers to explain exactly why, just before my body experiences its minuscule combustion, that hiss of a match as it catches fire, that surge in temperature, which in my case is far from a furnace. Why in that instant, just before, do I feel something is about to go terribly wrong, that something bad is about to happen? I experience a nanosecond of profound cosmic discomfort, and much more tremendous and depressing than simply losing my ability to accurately distinguish between hot and cold. This tiny apocalypse of hormones also makes it difficult to sleep or have regular bowel movements, or which the homeopaths, naturopaths, and creative marketers take advantage of in turn. This cosmic sorrow heralds the vulgarity of a hot flash, a warning that puts me on guard like the aura that's reportedly experienced just before an epileptic seizure or by a werewolf just noticing there's a full moon.
It sounds good.
Wow, it is good. It is good. Okay, well, this book has a lot of funny moments. despite a central theme of pain and vulnerability. So I'm going to ask you, Marco, what is your definition of humor? And what role does humor play in a story about a health crisis?
Bueno, yo creo que el humor es la manera que tenemos de afrontar, tanto en la vida real como en los libros, las situaciones más dolorosas y más desagradables. El humor, el sentido del humor es lo que nos hace sin duda seguir adelante.
Well, I think humor is how we face, both in real life and books, the most painful and the most unpleasant situations. I think humor is how we move forward.
Hay un humorista estadounidense que seguro que todos ustedes conocerán mucho mejor que yo, que es Lenny Bruce, que para mí puede parecer raro, pero es un referente. Creo que es un que era un ser humano con una situación personal angustiosa, terrible, una visión del mundo muy negra, y sin embargo era capaz de hacer unos monólogos crueles y al mismo tiempo enormemente divertidos. Entonces, esa manera de utilizar el humor para poder ver los asuntos más amargos del mundo es lo que a mí me interesa mucho. A Dorothy Parker también le pasaba.
Well, there's a U.S. Comedian, and I'm sure you know him better than I do. His name was Lenny Bruce. And you might find this strange, but for me, he was a referent. He was a person with a terrible, terrible personal situation and the darkest worldview you could find. And yet, his monologues were cruel, but they were also so funny. So I think this ability to use humor to tackle the bitter parts of life is essential, and Dorothy Parker understood this very well, I think.
Y os voy a contar algo que creo que no he contado muchas veces. Cuando yo publiqué Clavícula, tenía mucho miedo de que personas muy enfermas, muy, no sé, pues personas que estuvieran padeciendo un cáncer, una esclerosis múltiple, o sea, personas que estuvieran padeciendo enfermedades muy, muy graves, se sintieran insultadas por el sentido del humor del libro. Para mí era importante que no se sintieran insultadas estas personas. Curiosamente, mi miedo no tenía ningún fundamento porque son las personas que más lo han agradecido. Son personas que consideran que es muy importante que el dolor grande, pequeño, mediano, se haga visible. Entonces, no se sienten insultadas, sino que lo que se sienten es acompañadas, aunque los dolores de la mujer de clavícula sean más pequeños, más cotidianos, menos letales. Gracias a Magdalena. Es fundamental.
Let me tell you something that I don't think I've told a lot of people. When I published Clavicle, I was actually afraid that sick people, and by that I mean people that were suffering from a cancer, from multiple sclerosis, people that were truly, truly sick, I was afraid that they would feel insulted by the sense of humor in this book. And curiously, I found that my fear was unfounded because they actually appreciated that pain, whether it was big or small, that pain was seen, that was made visible, because it made them feel accompanied. It made them feel less lonely. And I think that when pain becomes visible, but then it becomes less lethal.
Y creo que hay algo muy importante en este libro, que es la reivindicación de nuestro derecho a quejarnos. Cuando nos suceden cosas, quejarnos. Otra anécdota. respecto a esto de la queja. Presenté este libro en un pequeño pueblo de la provincia de Toledo, en España, un pueblo llamado la Puebla de Almoradiel. Y allí me estaban esperando 50 mujeres. 50 mujeres que habían leído el libro en un club de lectura. 50, 25 me odiaban. Estaban esperando furiosas completamente. 50, otros 25 quiero decir, me amaban. Me amaban. Las 25 que me odiaban decían, ah, tú eres una privilegiada que te quejas por todo. Eres una pija, pero no sé si hay una traducción, pero una pija, va, cualquier cosa, eres como la princesa guisante del cuento. Y las otras 25 decían, quéjate, por favor, quéjate. Yo no quiero que mis trabajos diarios, mi sufrimiento diario, mi encargarme de la casa, los hijos, el trabajo, el atravesar un momento malo de mi vida, pasen desapercibidos y sean normales. Quéjate, por favor, quéjate. Deberíamos quejarnos más, me decían las otras 25 mujeres. Entonces, eso creo que es importante.
Well, there's something important in this book, which I think is claiming the right to complain. Let me tell you another story. When I presented this book in this very, very small town near Toledo, it's a very small town called La Puebla de Almoravien, there were 50 women who had read the book and they were waiting for me. Out of those 50, 25 absolutely hated me and they were waiting for me, gnashing their teeth. And the other 25 loved me. The 25 that hated me would tell me, oh, you are coming from such a place of privilege. You know, you are so posh coming here to complain about everything. You're like the tail of that lady on top of the, you know, 1,000 mattresses that complains about the one pea, like the princess of the pea. But the other 25, the ones who loved me, they would tell me, complain. Please complain. I don't want my daily chores, my daily life, which is made up of taking care of the kids, taking care of the house, and doing all of this through pain. I don't want it to be normalized and invisibilized. We should complain more. Please keep complaining.
Did you end up converting the ones that didn't love you into loving you?
Lo intenté. No, pero sí que es cierto que yo creo que esas mujeres de algún modo reflexionaron sobre que a veces llevamos muchos pesos encima y son muchos pesos que no se tienen en cuenta, que se dan por normales, que no se agradecen y es necesario agradecer. Hay otra escritora estadounidense que a mí me interesa muchísimo, Tilly Olsen. Tilly Olsen habla mucho de la relación entre la experiencia creativa de las mujeres y los cuidados. Cómo el hecho de que hayamos normalizado que las mujeres son quienes cuidan a los niños, a los ancianos, a los enfermos, a sí mismas, físicamente, exteriormente, estar presentables, te aleja muchas veces de tus vocaciones, de tus deseos, de tus capacidades artísticas. Entonces, no se agradece lo uno y se bloquea la posibilidad de lo otro. Entonces, Tilly Olsen habla de la relación entre el género y que muchas mujeres escriban relatos porque son más cortos, porque no tienen tiempo. Entonces, al final, todo está relacionado. Magdalena loves you. I love you so much.
I think, and I think this is true, that many women reflected, this conversation made them reflect on about the many burdens that we carry, all the things that we do, and that they're normalized, they're taken for granted, they're not seen, they don't evoke any kind of gratitude, and we should be able to be thanked for those. There's a U.S. writer that I find very interesting. Her name is Tilly Olson. She talks about the experience of creation, being a creative person, and then how it relates to caring for others. Since we normalize that women are usually the ones that care for children, care for the sick, care for the elderly, care for themselves, it's true that because they're caring for others, because they need to be physically and spiritually present for others, they don't have the time and they cannot be as present when they're trying to create or devote themselves to other endeavors. And it's true that there's a relationship between gender and the kind of fiction we write. For example, Tilly Olson says that the reason so many women write short stories is because they don't have the time to do anything bigger, anything longer.
Tilly Olson dice que, claro, que una mujer no podía escribir la gran novela americana, era imposible. No tenía tiempo, tenía que planchar.
Tilly Olson said that, you know, women could not write the great American novel because she wouldn't have the time for it. She has to iron everybody's clothes.
So what I'd like to do, because this book is full of great examples of complaining, in a very humorous way, especially when interacting with the healthcare industry, is read you one wonderful example from Marta's writing. This is a description of how the protagonist is going to multiple doctors and specialists and trying to get someone to help her figure out what the heck is going on. And this passage describes interaction with a cardiac stress test nurse. The cardiac stress test nurse is tall and stocky and speaks with a Canary Islands accent. She highlights her hair, draws cat eyes on her lids with brown eyeliner, and cuts her fingernails short. She wears regulation clogs and a white lab coat, but still manages to look disheveled. A cheap and ugly necklace hangs around her neck. You can barely see her collarbone. I will always remember her. She chugs down mineral water from a liter bottle. She smells like cigarette smoke. She smokes like a chimney, and that makes me realize that I now belong to that select group of mature individuals who obsess about their vices, their virtues, and their ailments. And it dawns on me that maybe the things we're moved to talk about are also the things worth writing about. Maybe there's no need to surgically separate everyday themes, like shopping for onions or making a copy of the house keys, from more literary themes. The nurse, whom I will never forget, smells of blonde leaf tobacco. And now that I've become one of the former smokers who's recovered her sense of smell, I begin to judge others like her, dividing humanity into the guilty and not guilty. The nurse who administers my stress test may be guilty of committing suicide by cigarette, but I'm not anymore. In the waiting room, everyone's checking out each other's shoes. Because I know it's not what they normally wear. Elderly patients should be allowed to come in wearing their slippers. I'm wearing moccasins with the laces loosely tied. They're the shoes I use to run errands around Madrid, the ones that don't cause blisters before my feet. Suddenly, I'm mortified that they'll turn me away because of the moccasins. But when it's my turn, the stress test nurse glances down toward my feet, but makes no objection. Are you comfortable? I nod briskly. This kind does not tolerate indecision or vacillation. Okay, then. Following protocol, she asks me if I've eaten anything before coming for the test. And I say no, and that I don't really understand having to fast for a test that consists of running on a treadmill. I say that I'd understand if it were an endoscopy or a blood test, but for running on a treadmill, it seems somewhat counterproductive to fast, and I might even faint. Of course, I say, I have a banana in my handbag to gobble down as soon as I'm done. I flash a smile. The nurse looks at me with a touch of disdain.
It's to avoid vomiting and a voice brimming with malice so you don't choke to death. The nurse undresses me from the waist up as if I were a child about to be bathed. She corrects my posture with a hard jab to the kidneys. She adjusts my bra straps. I'm surprised. I stiffen. In my mind, I question whether these apparent concessions to elegance and orthopedics are part of the protocol. But I keep quiet and for an instant forget about myself. The situation intrigues me because now I have something to write about. And also, I never could have adjusted my two bra straps with the physiotherapeutic professionalism that this woman has. The loose straps on my purple bra, the ones that always fall off my shoulder all the way down to my elbow, and I have to pull up by sticking my hand down awkwardly through the neck of my sweater, are transformed by the nurse's professional manipulation into two pulleys that lift my breasts to a height that they haven't reached in a long, long time. That's better. The nurse speaks with assurance, with satisfaction even. I take a breath, and the little wings of my scapulae unfold and tremble. I sit up straight. Then I'm no longer her mannequin as her focus turns to populating my chest, arms, temples, and wrists with stick-on electrodes attached to cables. I can't even tell you all the different parts of my body that get wired up. I can't tell if what I'm seeing is my body or a scene from a horror movie.
Esto fue, esto es un hecho real. Esto sucedió. Lo que ocurre que, claro, en la literatura es muy importante la subjetividad. Entonces, yo creo que la mirada cruel de quien está hablando en el texto responde al miedo. Yo estaba muerta de miedo. Entonces, todo lo que hacía aquella enfermera para mí era agresivo. Entonces, eso creo que es lo que transmite el texto. En la literatura no sabemos muy bien qué es la verdad. Quizá ella no fuera tan brusca. ¿Sí? Lo que sí que es cierto es que me arregló el sujetador. That actually happened. That happened. But in literature, subjectivity is very important. So the cruel point of view of the narrator in this book is that way because I was afraid. I was afraid, and so everything the nurse did to me seemed aggressive. And that's what the text conveys. In literature, we don't always know the truth. We know that she came out this way, but I'll tell you what, she did fix my bra strap.
Y una pequeña cosa que quería compartir. Cuando yo publiqué Clavícula en España, me llamaron de hospitales y tuve reuniones con médicos que querían que sus consultas no fueran tan agresivas, porque un médico no se da cuenta a veces de que la persona que tiene enfrente tiene miedo. Porque para lo que un médico quizá es pequeño, porque lo ve todos los días, para la persona que tiene enfrente puede llegar a ser gigante. Gigante. Entonces, hay una relación de desigualdad en las consultas que resulta violenta. Y eso hizo que a mí me invitaran a hospitales españoles para hablar de este asunto. No solo con médicos de la cabeza, también con médicos del hígado y el riñón y la garganta.
When I published Clavicle in Spain, I got calls from hospitals and doctors' offices from all over the country. They wanted to know how they could make their office less aggressive because they realized that, you know, they didn't realize that we are scared sometimes. And the problem is that something that to them is very small because they see it every day, it is not important, to us is huge. And so I think there's this inequality that takes place in doctor's offices that ends up being very violent. And that's why I was called from all these places in Spain, and not just from, you know, mental health doctors, but also from doctors that treated kidneys, throats, etc.
I knew time would go by really fast, and I promise I would keep our conversation to an hour. I have one more quick question, and then I know a lot of women in this room have read your book, and they have questions for you, because they've been asking me, and now I just want them to ask you, because they've been covering me. But one more quick question. One thing that struck me about feedback from women I know have read the book is that how intensely they respond to your descriptions of the often cavalier and sometimes dismissive attitudes in healthcare toward women, especially women's discomfort and pain and pathologies. You describe a Spanish experience, but it's resonating with readers here. So what accounts for this generalized societal dismissiveness of women's pain, and especially the discomfort of menopause, and why are they so quick to prescribe sedatives? And most importantly for this conversation, why does all of this make a good book?
Bueno, un libro consigue ser un buen libro porque elige las imágenes, las situaciones y las palabras adecuadas para hacerlo. Eso es lo que hace de un libro un buen libro. Al final, yo no importo. Al final, lo que importa es cómo las palabras consiguen crear un efecto que llega a las lectoras, a los lectores. Eso es lo importante. Eso es lo que hace un buen libro.
Well, I think a book is good when it knows how to choose the right images, the right situations, and the right words. When it creates an effect that reaches everyone, I don't matter. I think what matters is that words reach you.
La otra es una pregunta dificilísima. Dificilísima. Posiblemente todavía estamos viviendo con un modelo de cuerpo y un modelo de patologías y un modelo fisiológico basado en un cuerpo masculino. Y además de eso, estamos también en una sociedad donde, ¿cómo decir?, los problemas de las mujeres tienden a minimizarse. No tienen tanta importancia. Entonces, la menopausia, que es algo que puede producir estragos no solamente físicos, sino psíquicos, no tiene realmente un tratamiento médico específico. Creen que estás loca, que eres una exagerada, que esa profunda tristeza que se siente antes de un sofoco, de un pif, es una tontería. Y eso yo creo que también lo que nos muestra es que lo que se considera universal e importante es lo masculino, no lo femenino. Entonces, todo está un poco enlazado y no sé cómo resolverlo. Hablando.
Well, your other question is so, so hard to answer. I think that we are still living with a model of, with a physical, pathological, and physiological model that is essentially male-centric. And thus, society minimizes anything that affects women. Menopause, which can ravage you physically and mentally, is not medically treated specifically. They think you're crazy. They say that you're exaggerating. That the intense sadness that you feel before a hot flash is just silly. And so we are taught that anything universal and important is male, and that whatever is female, it doesn't really matter. And I think this is so, it's linked with this problem, and I don't know how to solve it. Talking about it, maybe?
Thank you, Marta. I want to open things up to questions because I know there are some questions out there because I've been harassing you. We are recording, so I'm going to bring a microphone around for you to ask your question.
Thank you for being an international humorist and recognizing American humor, appreciating it. And thank you for writing about women. Because women are under siege, so to speak, these days in this country, as well as remain so internationally, if you were writing the book today, how different might it be, if at all?
No sería diferente. sería el mismo libro, exactamente. De hecho, yo sigo escribiendo libros desde la conciencia de la desventaja. El último libro que yo he publicado en España, que se llama Los Íntimos, The Intimates, supongo, algo así, habla de las desventajas que sufrimos las mujeres en el mundo de la cultura y de en el mundo editorial, en el mundo de las artes, porque las mujeres estamos sometidas, por una parte, tienes que hacer más para llegar a lo mismo. Y estamos sometidas siempre a la sospecha de que cuando conseguimos alguna cosa, la hemos conseguido porque hemos rentabilizado nuestro capital erótico. Si yo gano un premio, ¿qué habré hecho? Si yo tengo una buena crítica y al mismo tiempo mi aspecto físico a veces se utiliza para valorar lo literario. Cuando yo quedé finalista del premio Nadal en España, que es un premio importante, lo primero que me dijeron, mira, esa es la fea que ha ganado el Nadal. Entonces, el cuerpo, desde la doble perspectiva de la apariencia física y de la sexualización que tú puedes aprovechar, funciona todo el rato. Y eso te coloca en una situación de desventaja. Entonces, yo sigo escribiendo desde esa conciencia de la situación de desventaja para que no se haga invisible.
¡Wow! ¡Qué rollo!
I think it would be the same book. I still write, and I write about the disadvantage of which many women in the world of culture and arts find themselves. My last book, which is called Los Íntimos, I don't know if in English it would be translated at the intimates, that's in Katie's hands, talks exactly about the disadvantage that women in culture and the arts and in the publishing world find themselves. Because women are expected to do more in order to get to the same place. And we are also supposed to overcome any suspicions that might hover around any victory we score. For example, if we win any awards, if we have any good reviews, people might suspect us of having used our erotic capital to achieve that award, of having gotten that good review because we're beautiful, because our physical aspect, our appearance is always a factor. There's more. For example, when I won the when I was a finalist for the Nadal Award, which is a very prestigious literary award in Spain, someone said to me, "Oh, look, that's the Ago, ugly. That's the Ago that won the Nadal." They pointed that out. So our bodies always have these two dimensions. There's a physical dimension and the sexual capital of the book, and that's always a factor, and that puts us at a disadvantage. And so I write about it so it doesn't become invisible. And I'm sorry, I went on too long.
That was a great question. Thank you, Marta. More questions?
And also fear of not being taken seriously because it was humor. And also being dismissed because you're a woman.
And I wondered if in the process of writing this book, it's not the first book, you know, it's a book that you wrote after you had published other books. If the fear felt while you were dealing with doctors and the fear that you felt of not being taken seriously because there was humor in your book, if at any point while writing the book, you doubted yourself whether the book should even have been written. If you were like, you know, this is going to offend too many people. People are going to dismiss me because I'm a woman, and they're going to think I'm complaining too much, and I'm just being dramatic about health conditions. If at any point you doubted that you should write the book.
Muchas gracias. Yo siempre que escribo, que estoy escribiendo un libro, me siento insegura. Siempre. Y creo que es un buen lugar desde el que escribir. Sentirse inseguro. Hacerse preguntas. Sentirse en el límite. Si estás completamente segura de algo, ¿para qué escribes un libro? No sé. Los libros son también herramientas de conocimiento personal y conocimiento de tu cultura, de tu comunidad. Entonces, yo escribo desde el lugar siempre de no saber, de preguntarme, ¿no? Entonces, creo que ese es el lugar importante desde el que se debe escribir. De ahí, así comencé a escribir y así sigo escribiendo.
Thank you so much for your question. Every time I write a book, I feel insecure, always. And I think that's a very good place to write from. You have to ask yourself questions. You have to feel on edge in a way, because if you're sure about something, why write? Writing books is like a tool of self-knowledge to know your culture and your community. So I always write when I don't know something. That's how I started writing, and that's how I still write.
Mi marido, que es protagonista de Clavícula, también sufre terriblemente cuando yo publico un libro y me dice, Marta, ¿por qué has puesto esto? No lo pongas, luego vas a llorar, te van a hacer daño. Entonces, me da más inseguridad todavía, pero yo creo que también con la escritura de alguna manera me empodero, siento alegría. Escribir es una forma de alegría también.
My husband, who's also a protagonist of the book, suffers so much whenever I publish any book, and then he says, Marta, why did you write this? You'll cry afterwards. They'll hurt you. And it makes me feel even more insecure. But writing also empowers me. It gives me the sense of power, and it makes me feel happy. It gives me joy.
Marta, I loved your book.
I wanted to ask you, the last page you referenced the Bosphorus as your clavicle, and how did you come up with that? Was that a metaphor for the book?
Bueno, es que yo soy, como comentaba al principio, para mí la cultura, los libros, las películas, terminan formando parte de mi propio cuerpo. Se me quedan en el cuerpo, la cultura se metaboliza. Entonces, yo vi una película hace muchos años que se llamaba El paciente inglés. Y en esa película que se llamaba El paciente inglés, uno de los personajes, al hablar de este agujerito que tenemos entre una clavícula y otra clavícula, decía que era el Bósforo de Almasi. Almasi era un personaje de esta película, que creo que está basada en un libro, y el Bósforo es o el estrecho, el estrecho. Entonces, de ahí sale la idea de que este lugar es el Bósforo de Al-Masi. Hay en otra película donde la clavícula y esta zona tiene mucha importancia, que es Sospecha, de Alfred Hitchcock. El personaje de Joan Fontaine, su vulnerabilidad frente a la mirada de Cary Grant es la clavícula.
Well, as I said in the beginning, culture, books, and films, these are things that become part of my body. In a way, culture is metabolized. I watched this movie many years ago called English Patient, and one of the characters, when addressing this little hollow that we have between the two clavicles, they call it the Bosphorus of Al-Masi. Al-Masi is one of the characters in the movie. And so the Bosphorus is just a way of calling it a little strait between these two bodies, right? There's also another movie that I think gave a lot of attention to collarbones or clavicles, which is called Suspicion by Hitchcock. And it is the character of Joan Fontaine. Her clavicle bone is actually an object of attention by Kelly Rand, another character.
pop quiz. How many people have seen The English Patient? Okay. How many people remember the protagonist's name, Al-Masi? You know who that is? It's a character played by Ralph Fiennes. And how many people remember the scene where he and Kristen Scott Thomas have become lovers and they're in the bed and he's tracing his finger across her clavicle? Does anyone remember that? Excellent. If you haven't, Google it, find the video, watch it, and then read My Clavicle. More questions? All the way. A man asking a question. This is so important.
I've witnessed the superiority with which a female doctor has treated female patients. So is this more an issue of gender or professional arrogance?
Puede ser que las dos cosas a la vez, las arrogancias se van sumando. Sí, pueden ser las dos cosas a la vez. Yo creo que sí que hay un problema de género básico que se percibe en prácticamente en todas las esferas de la vida pública, pero es probable que dentro del mundo de la medicina haya una superioridad por parte de profesionales poseedores de un conocimiento imprescindible que a veces olvidan la faceta humana, afectiva, la proximidad. Pero insisto, yo creo que las arrogancias no se excluyen una a la otra, sino que se van sumando.
I think probably both. I think arrogance is something that can be compounded. There is, I think, a basic gender issue that you can see everywhere, but especially in a field like medicine, where a few people hold knowledge that is so special and so vital to all of us. And it's sometimes those people also forget, you know, the human dimension, the emotional and affective dimension of the person they're treating. And so I think that it's not that arrogances can be mutually exclusive. I think they're compounded.
Okay, one more question, and then I'm going to drag Marta back to sign books in the back. Who else has a question? I have a question.
Yeah.
Should men read this book? Is it important?
Bueno, yo creo que es importante porque está tratando una cuestión universal. Y vuelvo a lo que comentábamos al principio. Yo leí con mucho interés libros que hablaban de aventuras épicas, asuntos que aparentemente solamente concernían a una parte de la humanidad, y entendí que eran míos. Es más, esos asuntos viriles y masculinos forman parte de mí y de mi identidad y de mi cultura. Y del mismo modo, yo creo que ni la maternidad, ni la menopausia, ni la menstruación, ni esas cosas pequeñas tradicionalmente relacionadas con las mujeres que luego hemos visto que forman parte de los hombres también, son ajenas a los propios hombres. Entonces, no hay libros de chicas. No hay libros de chicas, y libros de mujeres, y libros de hombres, y libros de viejos. Y no, hay libros. Yo puedo tener 30 años y leer libros maravillosos sobre la vejez. No tengo que ser vieja para leer un libro sobre la vejez. Y naturalmente no tengo que ser una mujer para leer un libro que hable de mujeres. Es más, los libros hay veces que nos sirven también para ponernos en otro lugar y crear una empatía. Y creo que eso es lo maravilloso de los libros.
Well, I think it's important they do. I think it's important men read this book because this is a universal issue. I've read books that told incredible epic adventures. They told stories that were technically stories about men. And I never felt them as something that was not meant for me. I felt that they were mine too. So these male-centered epics are also part of my world, part of who I am. Similarly, motherhood, menopause, menstruation, these small things that have always been just ascribed to the world of women should not be just for women. These also concern men. And so I think books are books. There aren't books for women or books for old people, books for young people. I think books are books. I could be 30 and be reading great books about old age. And I don't need to wait until I'm old to read about them the same way that, you know, you need to be a woman to read about women. And so what's more, I think that books are so important because they allow you to put yourself in someone else's shoes. It allows you to cultivate, to grow empathy.
Muy bien, Magdalena.
Excellent, Magdalena. Thank you. All right. Another round of thanks. First of all, to all of you, I can't thank you so much for coming here. It's really been great. Thank you for your questions. Thank you to Magdalena, but mostly thank you, Marta Sands. You're brilliant. It's so good. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.